Hello and welcome to the Books Podcast. I'm Claire Armistead. This week we're looking backwards to look forwards. Would you like to see a woolly mammoth walk the earth once more? We speak with science writer and broadcaster Britt Ray, whose book Rise of the Necrofauna explores the possibilities and searches for the potential heffalump traps of bringing extinct animals back to life. But first, Michael Brooks takes the idea of looking backwards to understand today better and spins it on its axis. A scientist, broadcaster and writer by trade, he decided that his only way into writing the biography of the pioneer in probability and complex numbers, Jerome Cardano, was to go there himself. So, playing with the idea that in quantum physics, particles can become entangled across time and space, Brooks takes himself to 1570 to meet the great man himself. When he came to The Guardian to speak with Richard Lee, Michael began by reading from the Quantum Astrologer's Handbook, from the very moment when Michael enters Cardano's freezing prison cell in Bologna.
Jerome has been in this cell for 11 weeks since his arrest. The weather has turned cold and damp, and he struggles to keep himself warm. Until yesterday, he had no idea why he was in prison. No one would tell him anything. The hunched man who brings fresh straw every day refuses even to look at him. The tall, thin boy who brings the food smiles as he sets the bowl down on the writing desk, but has nothing to offer but a shrug in response to Jerome's questions. Yesterday, though, a new face entered the cell. When the guard turned the key and opened up the door, the stranger took one step in, threw down the yellow robe, smirked, turned, and walked away. And then Jerome knew. He puts down his pen and turns his attention to the robe that now smothers his emaciated frame, pulling at it as if it burns his skin. It is embroidered with demons who are using forks and fiery flames to torture hapless, grimacing men. Jerome knows its significance. It is what the heretics wear when led to the stake. We are in December now. Christmas is coming, and the last light of the day is fading ever earlier. The cell is small and dark, with a window big enough only for a small boy to climb through. It has been many decades since Jerome was a small boy. He is sat behind a rickety desk, a small mercy afforded to him by the authorities. Perhaps they hope he will write more blasphemies and make their case easier to prosecute. Jerome looks up from the robe and stares at me through the gloom. He's not sure if I'm an apparition. I'm not sure either. Eventually, without shifting his gaze from my eyes, he puts his fingers to his mouth and pulls out a small emerald. It is held on a chain around his neck. He lets the stone fall to his chest. "Do I know you?" he says. His voice is thin and high-pitched, reedy, entirely unbecoming to a man in his seventh decade. "I don't think so," I say. "Did they send you to spy on me?" "They?" "My inquisitors." He pulls at the yellow robe again. "No." I break from his gaze and survey the cell again. "I'm just here, as far as I can tell. It's all I have to offer." It seems to satisfy. "Oh," he says. He picks up the pen again. "Well, welcome then." "Are you writing to Archbishop Hamilton?" I say. He stares at me. "Why would I do that?" "To ask for his help." Jerome shakes his head. "He'll be dead by now," he says. "I'm sure of it. I've read the history books, and I know the truth. He's not. Your treatment was more successful than even you might have hoped." I hesitate, unsure whether this constitutes some breach of the rules of engagement. I decide I don't care. Nobody has told me the rules. "You should write to him," I say. And that is how, I like to think, I came to save the life of Jerome Cardano.
So, who was Jerome Cardano, and how did your obsession with him begin?
So Jerome Cardano was a 16th century polymath, really. He was an astrologer, mathematician, astronomer, physician, mathematician already. He kind of has this kind of list of things that he did.
It's a rotating gambler list.
Yeah, yeah. And my obsession with him began actually when I was researching another book and I came across him. I was looking at sources of creativity in science. And most scientists will say, you know, that they get inspiration from thinking or, you know, something occurs to them. And Jerome recorded in his autobiography that he got his inspiration from the visits of a ministering spirit.
You put it right out there.
Yeah, quite an unusual kind of way of attributing your greatness to somebody else. And he did, you know, he had an amazing sort of inventions. You know, he invented the cardan joint, which is on all our cars still now. So he has this sort of trail of inventions. He has this trail of great ideas, incredible and important mathematical discoveries. And he says, oh, yeah, I got it all from this sort of guardian angel. And his colleagues at the time were kind of, you know, a bit horrified by this kind of attribution because it made them all look bad. So I just became sort of obsessed with this idea of somebody who wasn't willing to take the credit for everything that he did. And I started sort of reading more about him. So I obviously read his autobiography because I wanted to find out where this whole thing was coming from. And then I sort of, you know, gradually got to like him more and more. And then I started reading the other things that he wrote that I could access. And then, you know, there was a Victorian biography in two massive volumes, which is, you know, quite difficult to read, but really good fun at the same time, because it's just everything is in there. And so, you know, this obsession just grew. So by the time I'd done all this reading and kind of felt like I was really getting to know this man, I really felt this sort of compulsion to bring him to other people's attention, because he'd just fallen away from sort of our common culture.
Because, I mean, he's not a familiar name at all, but no. I mean, he's great mathematician.
Yeah. I mean, the inventor of probability theory.
Yeah, you know, hundred years before
anybody else had really sort of, you know, so you had people like Blaise Pascal and Pierre de Fermat trying to solve probability, and actually had been solved sort of 100 years previously.
He got it.
He'd done it. Yeah. And most mathematicians aren't really aware. They might know the name, but they're not really aware of, you know, who he was in the way that we're aware of Newton and we're aware of Leibniz and all these other sort of figures.
Yeah, and not just probability. I mean, he's imaginary numbers as well.
Yeah, so these imaginary numbers that everybody hated at school and everybody thought, what's the point of these things? It turns out they're really important. I mean, they're massively important in engineering, and every kind of modern technology effectively uses these things. He discovered them when he was solving cubic equations and quartic equations, and decided that, you know, other people had sort of seen that they might be there beforehand, these strange things which are the square root of negative numbers. People had seen that they might be there, but they'd assumed they'd made a mistake in their calculations previously and just sort of thought, well, you can't have the square root of a negative number, therefore, you know, I've done something wrong. And he said, no, you know, this is there. And
He looked them in the eye.
He said, these are neither positive numbers nor negative numbers, but some recondite third sort of thing, was how he put it, which I really like. You know, it's like, I don't know what it is, but it's real.
It's there. Yeah. No, I mean, he may have been, you know, doing astrology and mathematics and medicine and all that stuff, but he definitely wasn't doing quantum mechanics.
So what's the link? So I did my PhD in quantum physics. And so I was able to see that, you know, the two sort of pillars on which quantum physics are built are probability, because you can't ever say anything happens for certain in quantum physics. It always happens with a certain probability. And the other thing is imaginary numbers, which are required in the mathematics. So the whole of quantum theory centers around the Schrödinger equation. You know the name from Schrödinger's cat. And the Schrödinger equation contains imaginary numbers. And they are an essential part. It doesn't work without them. So here's this guy back in the 16th century who invented both these things. And somehow, you know, they've sort of found their way through and become this central pillar of what is our best theory in physics. And I kind of wanted to go back and talk to him about that.
It's kind of what happened to your ideas.
This legacy, which is extraordinary. And, you know, he's not really been given any wide credit for this at all. I just think it was, you know, for me, it just followed on from this obsession of finding out about him to sort of put the two together, really.
I mean, he was also kind of a fortune teller. He sort of read your fortune from the lines on your forehead.
He did all kinds of weird and we would call stupid things.
But his attitude to astrology is kind of very similar, you say, to our attitudes to quantum mechanics, that he doesn't know how it works, but it kind of does.
He thinks it works, but he's very questioning of it. So even as an 18-year-old, I think he was writing a letter to a friend, which we've still got, which sort of says, you know, my father, who taught me all this stuff, and it was, you know, very much part of a young man's education to learn astrology. My father sort of swears by this, but I'm not entirely convinced. I don't understand how something so distant could have, you know, such a distinct effect, especially depending on geography. So, you know, something happens in China, or Cathay, as he put it, you know, and also, you know, the same influence arrives in Milan, and it's a completely different influence. And he says, that doesn't feel right, effectively. So, and that wasn't a new thing. I mean, lots of Roman philosophers had questioned astrology.
Yeah, sure, but this kind of attitude towards it of, okay, I don't really understand it, but I'm going to use it anyway.
Yeah,
it's kind of, as
yeah.
you say, where we're at now with quantum mechanics.
Yes, definitely.
Do you think that's an indication there's something wrong, that the quantum mechanics needs fixing?
Well, I wouldn't say fixing. I mean, it's an extraordinarily successful theory. It needs developing. There is another theory that sort of lies behind quantum physics that we don't have any access to. We don't know how to get there, but we know it must be there. Because quantum physics doesn't give us answers about the entire universe. So you know, in modern physics, it's all about really trying to tie together Einstein's relativity with quantum physics and make this sort of ultimate theory of the universe.
Yeah, what's your kind of, what's your hunch, what's your gut feeling about what that theory is going to be, where it's going to lie?
My gut feeling is it's going to lie outside of space and time. So our big problem is that you know, we can only do our experiments within space and time, you know, which is, you know, quite a legitimate restriction. But what we see in quantum theory is that there are things going on outside of these sort of dimensions of space and time that we exist in. So there's going to be something that explains some external influence into our universe that explains this kind of quantum weirdness. That's as far as I can go. You know, the best minds in the world haven't got a clue, to be honest.
Yeah, but you reckon it's to do with being connected to some further reality.
There's something outside of the universe, yeah.
Looking back at the writings of people like Cardano, from the perspective of 21st century as we are, some of his theories sometimes look amazingly prescient. But are we just reading modern concepts into his words?
It's really difficult. So he made a sort of stab at a cosmology of the universe, and he's talking about eternity and how time flows within this sphere. And then, you know, it's kind of this convoluted string of words that actually ends up meaning absolutely nothing. But I like the fact that he tried. You know, he wanted to explain the whole universe. Give it a go. Why not? And it's sort of in some ways no weirder than string theory, which is our best theory of sort of quantum gravity at the moment. So, you know, I think give him credit for sort of seeing that somebody needs to put all this stuff together. So I wouldn't go back and say, oh, yes, you know, I'm sort of reading this as a modern take. I would say, you know, he's struggling with exactly the same concepts that we are. You know, we have this concept of eternity. We don't know whether the universe is infinite. We're trying to work out, you know, whether there are other parallel universes sort of next door to ours, as it were. And I think when possibly, you know, it's only 500 years, we're possibly not much further along than he was. And maybe in 1,000 years' time, people will look back and laugh at what we've written as well.
Sure, I mean, but it's just reading it, it's when he says it is in fact magic when something is done on natural principles, concealed though these are, it's impossible not to think of Arthur C. Clarke.
Absolutely. Do you know, I thought that this morning. I was reading through some stuff and I thought, oh, that's Arthur C. Clarke's line, isn't it?
Yeah, right there.
Any sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic.
Exactly.
And but that's exactly what Cardano was writing.
So is that that in some sense both of them were onto the same thing, or is that that if you look at enough clouds you see the shape of some animal?
I think both of them are onto the same thing. You know, I fundamentally think that the human brain hasn't changed very much. Certainly in those 500 years and possibly not in 100,000 years of evolution. And so people do sort of, and we have this big myth that, you know, somehow there were these dark ages where people weren't able to think properly and clearly. And I think Cardano really skewers that, in that there are things that he thinks, and they are ridiculous. So he thinks an elephant getting on board a ship extracts a, you know, well, it won't get on board a ship until he extracts a promise from people that yeah, he will return to where from whence he was taken. I mean, you know, what was he thinking when he came up with that? It's just, you know, it just seems mad. But at the same time, he's analysing conjurer's tricks and saying, well, you know, this is not demons. And he did believe in demons. You know, he did believe in this spiritual alternate reality. But he said, this isn't demons. This is just skill. And this is, you know, if you could work out how they did it. And I think that's the same as the kind of, you know, the great Randy or as you say, Arthur C. Clarke, that kind of sense of, yes, we're easily befuddled. Our human brains are very limited, but we can think some things through.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you say he did actually believe in demons. I mean, straightforwardly, yeah. Those were part of his worldview. Yeah. I mean, was this gap between that kind of worldview and our own one of the reasons why you didn't want to write just a conventional biography?
I think it's partly that. I never really wanted to do a conventional biography, partly because it sort of underplays the... It's very difficult if I do a conventional biography to talk about quantum physics and my kind of connection with Jerome.
Because you really feel connected to this guy.
I do feel this very strange sort of entanglement with him. And
a quantum entanglement.
A quantum entanglement, quite. And so I kind of wanted to explore that rather than just, you know, a straight biography. It's doable, but it didn't feel like that would sort of get across the kind of complexity and the depth and the richness of this legacy of his.
And a story in which you yourself appear.
Yeah. Yeah, that was kind of accidental, in a sense, in that I've sort of been, you know, working with this and struggling with this for a long time, working out how to write it and how to put it all together. And there was just one day I literally woke up and I thought, oh, this visiting spirit that he's always writing about and talking about, And it was a kind of back to the future moment. It's like, what if it was me? And because I'd become so obsessed with him and so sort of intertwined with him, and my brain was sort of becoming very focused on who he was and how he was thinking and things like this, I think there was part of me that felt like, I needed to have conversations with him anyway.
It began to seem perfectly reasonable.
It seemed at the time perfectly reasonable, yes.
Is this more literary device also a way of snagging readers who might not think they were really interested in quantum mechanics?
That wasn't deliberate. It was literally the only way I could work out how to write the book. And I wrote the book sort of not really knowing who would read it, who would want to read it. I wrote it for myself, if I'm honest. I thought, I have to get all this stuff out of my head. And I didn't tell anyone that I was doing this at all, because
guilty secret.
It was my guilty secret, and it just seemed ridiculous. Whenever I would talk to a friend about the book, I would just end up saying, I don't know why I'm doing this. This is madness.
And yet here he is, here he is.
Yeah.
Do you think it matters if people feel it's okay not to understand about quantum mechanics?
Oh, well, nobody understands quantum mechanics. I mean, that's famously what Richard Feynman said about it. If you think you understand it, you've missed something. And I think it's really important that people feel more comfortable. You know, people sort of feel this reverence towards it and this sort of sense of, I could never get my head around this. And it's kind of true, but it doesn't mean you can't try. And there's a whole sort of cohort of physicists who are trying to get their heads around it, and philosophers, trying to understand it, trying to make sense of what it means. And nobody has got to the truth yet. And there are lots of different sort of interpretations of what it actually means in terms of our understanding of reality. And I like to bring people to that and say, look, here's the feast that's laid out before you. It's a buffet. You can choose which you like. You know, do you like the idea of information coming back from the future, which is one person's sort of take on how all this quantum weirdness happens? Somebody else, you know, or lots of other people believe there are parallel universes in which you are a different, slightly different being who've made different choices. And then you've got this whole sort of list of ways of explaining our quantum experiments, and nobody knows which is right, and it's not wrong to choose any of them. And I think people should be sort of aware that science isn't sort of all set in stone and done, but it's an ongoing process that's still, you know, it's still unfolding. And there are still arguments, massive arguments between all these physicists about who's right.
But do you think in a world of climate change and Donald Trump and so on, do you think that stories of science, inspiring people to get interested in science, is kind of a duty of a citizen?
I often shy away from duty. I kind of feel like, it's interesting to me, and I can't, you know, say that, you know, it's interesting to everybody. You know, I have two children, one of whom is quite interested in science. The other one just could not get herself more distance from it if she tried, you know. And so some people naturally love this kind of stuff. Some people don't. I don't think anybody has a duty to love it. But I want, you know, people who do have a love of it to feel able to access it. I don't want it to feel like a distant thing. And I've, you know, throughout my whole kind of career, been privileged to spend lots of time with scientists and talk to them and find out that they are very human beings, you know, with all their flaws and all their kind of, you know, ignorance in so many ways. And I think that's really an important realization, is they're not sort of some race of superhumans. And I think often that's how science is taught in school. You know, you get shown a picture of Isaac Newton and you get told what a genius he was. And you don't ever get told all the stupid stuff that he did. And I think that's kind of important. Whereas, you know, when we're teaching art, you know, we talk about Van Gogh and you'll hear about him cutting his ear off and going mad and everything else. And somehow, you know, that doesn't come across in science lessons. And I think that's the problem, is this portrayal of scientists as if they're not really human.
Yeah, because you were almost one of these not really human people yourself. Why did you swerve away?
I discovered that my attention span was too short to actually have a career as a scientist. So when I was doing my PhD, it was interesting to me, but everything everybody else was doing was really interesting to me as well. So I'd find myself flitting around from lab to lab, sort of looking at what other people were doing. And I kind of decided that I was probably better suited to looking at it from the outside rather than spending the next sort of 50 years of my life on one thing. I just couldn't see myself doing that.
It was the kind of level of focus required that wasn't
there. Yeah. Also, I think one of the problems is with academia at the moment is that when you're doing a PhD, especially in science, it's kind of assumed that you're doing it so that you will carry on and do this thing for the rest of your life. And actually, I think we need people who have a good scientific training to go out in all kinds of walks of life. You know, we need politicians and we need, you know, TV presenters and we need writers and we need
biographers.
And biographers who understand science and are comfortable with it and aren't put off by it.
That was Michael Brooks speaking with Richard Lee. Looking out of the Guardian studio window here in London, I wonder what it would feel like if a Diplodocus were to wander past, or a dodo to waddle along the canal below, nudged into the water perhaps by a passing woolly mammoth on its daily commute. Nostalgic and lovely it might seem, but would it really be a good thing to bring back animals which, for whatever evolutionary reason, have died out? Apart from the technical complexities of making it happen, it's an ethical minefield, and one which science writer and broadcaster Britt Ray has tackled head-on in her new book, Rise of the Necrofauna. When she came to speak with me, I began by asking her what necrofauna means.
Necrofauna as a term itself is just made up.
Who made that up?
I get a lot of sideways looks about that word. People thinking, what are you onto here? So it just means dead animals. The Latin prefix necro with fauna as in flora and fauna. However, I first heard it spoken by a futurist who's named Alex Steffen when I was reading about him being at a meal with a variety of the de-extinction advocates who are galvanizing resources to push the ideas in the field further. And he said, you know, aren't we potentially just going to create a bunch of charismatic necrofauna with this movement in science? And by that he meant, won't we just choose the candidates for de-extinction that are somehow majestic, beautiful, cuddly, cute, look back at us with a spark of intelligence and somehow make us feel good, while we prefer that all of those less charismatic specimens stay in their graves forever? Isn't this a human project more than an ecological project? And I thought that that was quite interesting and provocative, because we also see a lot of this kind of charismatic bias in conservation as it is, in terms of which endangered species the public gets excited about saving while allowing particularly a lot of invertebrates to go over the brink of extinction and lay forgotten, essentially.
So what we're talking about is bringing back to life extinct species.
We're talking about bringing...
Or not.
Well, it's a great question, because de-extinction suggests in just that word that maybe we could undo extinction or reverse the erasure of an entire way of life for a species, and that is not possible. What we can do instead is create new animals that are close, approximate versions of extinct species. So it's always something novel in the world. However, you can get to different degrees of closeness of that extinct species depending on the method used.
Why would you want to do this?
Those who do want to do it say that consider the loss of a particular species, such as a keystone species, which we know had an important functional role to play in an ecosystem. When that disappears...
Such as,
well, the passenger pigeon is a superorganism in terms of having had billions of members of this species that would flock together. And when they would come down into a forest, they would disrupt that forest, and that would carry out a variety of roles in a kind of ripple effect that would definitely have an impact on that ecosystem. So getting a bird back that could flock in such numbers would have an effect in that ecosystem itself, which we can talk about further if you'd like specifically. But
let's just the passenger pigeon. So we know that Martha, the last passenger pigeon, died in, is it 1917, was it? Or
1914.
And this was a massive extinction from millions, certainly, if not billions of birds within 50 years to total extinction. So, I mean, why would we want to have billions of birds back? Because obviously we're managing fine without them.
So I'll just quickly talk about ecological restoration, and then we can go into the passenger pigeon example, because de-extinction advocates want to essentially restore a hole in nature that they believe has been emptied out once what they consider to be a keystone species has disappeared. So this is a species that we know had an important role to play, and when it disappears, those relationships between the flora and fauna that it kept dynamic disappear. So if we have the tools to be able to bring back a species that can act like that keystone species, they say we ought to try and do it to restore that ecosystem, as though there's a gaping crevice which we can fill in. Now, this is contested. This is ecologically debatable as to whether or not ecosystems even work like that. However, yes, so the passenger pigeon, you're right. In less than 50 years, they went from billions to none. It's really hard for us to fathom, but there were flocks of these birds. There are records going over Hamilton in my home province in Canada of Ontario that would take 14 hours for a flock to pass overhead. They would darken the skies. One single bullet could make anywhere between 25 and 99 birds fall down because they layered that thick as they flew. So, wow, we can just imagine the kind of disruptive effect they had on ecosystems. Ben Novak, who's the lead scientist of the Passenger Pigeon De-Extinction Initiative, says that if you think of the forests in eastern North America where they used to live, there are closed canopy systems. These have really dense foliage in the canopy of the branches overlapping, which prevents the sunlight from coming in and hitting the forest floor. If it were an open canopy, then more penetration of energy and sunlight nutrients at the forest floor would allow regeneration of a variety of different forms of life down below. Now, when multiple millions to a billion passenger pigeons were coming through these forests to roost and nest, they would break the canopy, scratch bark off trees, knock over young, dying, and sick saplings, and effectively cause a disturbance, which then promotes the successive regeneration of the forest's next life cycle. We know that forests around the world rely on different types of disturbance today, hailstorms, fire, tornado, to get to that next successional forest that grows after disturbance. And so he says that when we don't have those huge amounts of disturbance today, it might be desirable to get enormous amounts of pigeons back to perform that ecosystem service and then allow the regeneration of more life down below the canopy.
But everything's changed. I mean, gaps in the ecology don't just stay gaps, do they? They
right.
close over.
I mean, it could be a profoundly anti-ecological argument to say that ecological restoration can work in this way, as though there's plug-and-play repair where you can effectively return something to an ecosystem and then revert it back in time to what it was once like. Of course, these ecosystems haven't been on standby since certain species went extinct. They've been adapting to the disappearance or loss of that species. So creating an animal and reintroducing them in large numbers could create a new novel tertiary environment for that ecosystem that hasn't been seen in the past.
You have two emblematic case studies, as it were. One is the passenger pigeon and the other is the mammoth. We all wanted the mammoth to come back in a way, don't we? So you look at all the arguments, pro and con, and really fascinating argument, which I hadn't appreciated before, was the argument for the possibility of it helping to conserve the Indian elephant, which is its closest relative.
Yes, the Asian elephant.
Sorry, the Asian elephant.
Yeah. Yes. This is quite interesting. So de-extinction is about hybridization in some cases when you're using gene editing in order to modify the Asian elephant embryo or Asian elephant genome with woolly mammoth specific traits, as is the method being pursued by George Church and his colleagues at Harvard. And yes, you could say, well, we're trying to recreate a woolly mammoth by doing this kind of gene editing of the genetic identity of an elephant. Or you could say we are imbuing an elephant with traits that allow it to now live in a range that it currently can't inhabit with its particular traits. So by giving it the ability to bind and release oxygen in its blood at freezing temperatures and thicker subcutaneous fatty skin that could keep it warmer and smaller ears to allow less heat to escape, you can essentially design an elephant that will now be able to inhabit places like Siberia rather than simply staying in other more native habitats to it. So you could see it as a conservation project. At the same time, others might say that that's recreating a woolly mammoth.
I mean, that could be conceived as good for the elephant if the elephants are being hunted to extinction, as we're always being told they are. But also there's this other aspect of it, which is it good for the Siberian tundra, this sort of, or the permafrost?
Right, yes. So the ecological hypothesis about why a woolly mammoth elephant hybrid might be productive for the environment is that if you think of where it used to roam in places like the Yukon in Canada and Siberia in Russia, there are enormous swaths of land that are just containing permafrost, and this permafrost is filled with carbon-rich soil. It's because millennia worth of animals that have lived there have died, fallen into the ground, but even more importantly, the vegetation that they fed on is locked up in that permafrost. However, we're learning that permafrost is a poor name for this material because it's not actually permanently frozen. With climate change, things are warming, these soils are thawing, and as they thaw, their carbon contents are releasing into the atmosphere. And this becomes dangerous, especially because there are microbes everywhere that chew away at the stuff, and they turn it into carbon dioxide or methane, which are two of the greenhouse gases that got us into our climate predicament as it already is.
And you say there's three times as much carbon dioxide trapped under the permafrost as there is already in the atmosphere.
Estimated between two and three, yes. So that's quite something in terms of runaway release. We want to keep these soils locked frozen to contain that carbon as much as possible. And now there's a lot of interesting research to understand how quickly it's releasing and at what rate we can imagine that more thawing will occur. But in the meantime, the Woolly Mammoth Project is set up to try and engineer that ecosystem to keep it locked in. And it's by looking at what is there presently, there's a lot of snow. There's basically an insulating blanket that is not as disrupted by the activity of animals as it once was when there were many megafauna around in the Pleistocene. Now, there still are a lot of herbivores up there. There's a lot of reindeer, for example, different types of horses, wapiti. And so the productivity, though, they want to increase in terms of what the animals do on that snow, and that's they trample. In the winter months, they push snow around and look for blades of grass to eat. And this perforates through that insulating snowy blanket, and this allows colder air from the atmosphere to come down and reach the topsoils of the permafrost and essentially act like mobile ventilating systems as these animals run around and do what animals do. Now, the idea is that woolly mammoths have much more heft and potentially even more aggression than some of the other available animals that are there. We know that they're related to elephants, and elephants tend to have quite the energy for stampeding and knocking things over. So if we create a bunch of cold-tolerant elephants or pseudo-mammoths that can walk around and eat dark, light-absorbing plants and knock over other stumps and fertilize the soil with their dung to give
that
rise
warm
to
the, light. I'm thinking of the dung, right? That'll warm up. Clumps of earth.
Oh, that's an interesting point. Could. I mean, the idea there is that it could fertilize grassy vegetation, which would be more light reflecting than light absorbing, and over time somehow engineer that ecosystem to allow those soils to stay more frozen than they are. Now, it's, you know, there are so many and maybes and maybes and maybes in this theory. However, there are some suggestions based on current research to show that trampling does reduce the temperature quite drastically. Sergei Zimov, who runs an outpost, the Northeast Science Station in Pleistocene Park, a cordoned off area in Siberia, has been experimenting with how to keep this soil frozen. And by trampling with available herbivores, he has found that there's about a 15 degree temperature drop of the soil.
So on the one hand, you've got George Church in Harvard doing this sort of very lab-based stuff about cloning mammoths. On the other hand, you've got this sort of wild Russian family, father and son, trying to import bison and getting caught in customs and things. I mean, it's a sort of farce in a way, that what they're trying to do, isn't it? They keep hitting obstacles in their attempts to re-import heavy fauna into their park.
They've had some difficulty, yes. There were some donated bisons from the Canadian government that got caught and never made their way to their park. They also tried to buy some more from France, and they got caught in customs. And
the extent that they were advertising anybody wanted herd of bisons in France.
That's right. On their website, there's a little post saying, well, you know, they've been living there for a year now at the border. We can't get them through. Anyone want to buy some bison?
And then some was confiscated by Russia and sent somewhere else.
That's exactly right.
So I mean, this is actually not like science, is it? In a way, it's a sort of like a cowboy story in a way. These sort of, you don't want to use the word mad because they're not mad, but these people with more money than sense, one might say, who are sort of doing this, that and the other and not actually dealing with the real world, which is a lot about custom border controls and authorities.
I wouldn't say that the Russian scientists have much money. They're really taking research funds from scientists who want to come use their outpost for their own projects every year, and then they use that money to fund their research in Pleistocene Park to see if they can keep essentially the permafrost frozen through different ways of testing out animal trampling and other methods. But those are two cases in which things went awry. But generally, no, they go out in their spare time. They collect animals from all over. They go to very distant places like Wrangel Island to collect muskox and bring them back, or collect wapiti and trek for 26 hours in a truck with these live animals to see if they can actually live in their park. And they face a lot of trials along the way. But they will support a mammoth if it ever gets, quote-unquote, de-extincted, coming to live in their park. But they say, we don't care if it's a mammoth. If it has 6 horns or 19 legs or what have you.
Or caterpillar wheels, which they're using at the moment.
Exactly. As long as there's something with bioabundance to trample the snow, then we're interested in it. They wish the mammoth de-extinctors, if we can call them that, luck. But they're just counting biomass to see if they can fill out an ecosystem role. And they don't think that de-extinction is the necessary key to affect the permafrost in the way that they want.
Now, I want to talk about what sort of book this is, because I'm sort of actually weirdly interested in this subject. And I read Beth Shapiro's book 2 years ago, How to Clone a Mammoth. And as she said to you, I think she said, well, she could have called it How One Might Go About Cloning a Mammoth Should It Become Technically Possible. And if it were, in fact, a good idea, which it's probably not.
Right.
Why write this book? Because we know that it isn't possible to clone a mammoth.
Cloning is not possible, but gene editing is. There are many other subtleties when you look into it as to what are the methods being used and what are the eventualities that they might create, which are moving ahead. So the reason why cloning a mammoth is not possible is because there have been a variety of teams, for example, in South Korea and Japan, looking at mammoth carcasses. We know that every few years, a beautifully preserved mammoth carcass gets pulled out of a place like Siberia. And the idea is that we might be able to find a perfectly preserved cell in these carcasses in order to do cloning. Now, you need a perfectly preserved cell to create this clone that requires a process called somatic cell nuclear transfer, which requires pulling out the nucleus, which is the package with most of the DNA of the organism inside of the animal you want to clone, and then transferring it over into an egg cell from another living animal. In this case, it would be an Asian elephant, its closest relative, that has its native nucleus removed, and then stimulating that to start dividing with an electroshock and implanting it. But we never have perfectly preserved mammoth cells. It just hasn't happened. I mean, they've been gone a long time, they've been degrading, and although frozen on ice, it hasn't been perfect preservation.
So just going back to the question of what sort of book this is.
Yes.
Well, it's not the same sort of book as Beth's, because Beth was talking from her research. Yours is an overview, isn't it, of all the different positions and
right.
all the different characters working in this quite science fiction-y sort of territory.
Yeah.
So why do you want to write this book? Why do you think it's important? You've obviously invested a lot of time.
Yes. So I am fairly passionate about the extinction crisis. I was trained as a biologist, and conservation biology is my most favorite way to explore biology. And when I heard about de-extinction, I was very skeptical. I thought, okay, that's very quixotic. I don't know if this is being taken that seriously. And then I realized that there are some heavy hitters and really accomplished scientists working to making this come to life through a variety of different types of techniques. And I was both really interested to see if what they were proposing, which is that we could actually restore ecosystems in some beneficial way and produce a new gamut of tools for conservation, is something we should take at face value, or if there were ways that perverse incentives might be able to come and infiltrate the field, for example, with the patenting of animals. Also,
tourism.
Tourism, yes, exactly. That's another huge way that people may want to have de-extinction come to life in order to attract tourists. I read a paper that some tourism scholars had written about how de-extinction creates the possibility for what they call, quote-unquote, first-chance tourism, because we already have last-chance tourism, where tourists flock to see endangered species before they fall over the brink forever of extinction. And here we might be able to create a market around seeing the first members of an extinct species or a close version of them come back into the world. And I was basically just very curious, because I also thought, you know, it could be a dangerous techno fix, or I haven't learned about it enough yet. I want to see if there are some really important conservation benefits. And I was curious enough to go out and talk to everyone I possibly could about what they think. And what I've discovered is that no one is meh about de-extinction. No one thinks, let's just see what they can do, at least not yet. People are extremely passionate and believe that this is a fantastic thing, or they are so troubled and worried and even scolding of me for paying attention to it and writing a book.
There is the question in the introduction you pose about whether you should have written this book.
Yes.
Because as you, it's like opening Pandora's box, isn't it? It's like imagining a future that could then come to happen. And
yeah.
What's one of the fascinating things is you think, well, in 1993, Jurassic Park was written, and here you are as a scientist going through all the imaginative scenarios that actually were imagined in fiction first.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, we see that science fiction informs scientific discovery and technology development in a variety of different areas. Here, with de-extinction, it's very interesting because it was rooted in the idea of a real scientific expert who's a paleoentomologist, George Poynard Jr., who in the 1980s, when he was part of a research group that focused on ancient DNA, they were surmising about, how old might some of these bugs be that are in these resin-encased blobs of amber that they have at home? And they dated them, and they were able to date some of these amber chunks with insects inside back to when the duck-billed dinosaurs lived. And they realized, there are these engorged bellies inside these bugs, inside the amber, and that must be filled with blood. And now we have a hypothesis about whose blood that might be, the dinosaur. And they got to having some pints and enjoying themselves and talking about how you might be able to actually extract some useful information about that dinosaur from its blood. And they came up with a only theoretical methodology for getting dinosaur DNA out of blood molecules out of the bug. And they published this idea in a university journal, just not one to be taken seriously, but one to be thought about as an experiment of the mind. And this paper found itself in Michael Crichton's hands, the famous writer. And he contacted George Poynter Jr. and said, I'm writing this piece. I would like to pick your brain about how, you know, you've come up with these ideas about getting dinosaur DNA. And George Poynter Jr. said, oh, yeah, of course, come over and we can chat. And his son, Hendrik, tells me that he remembers his father kicking himself afterwards, just wishing that he'd seen the potential for a bestseller in front of him. But he knew that Michael Crichton was probably better at dramatizing the narrative. But one thing led to another, and essentially this idea from the fun and experimental imagining of a variety of ancient DNA scientists was what then informed the fiction. And now the fiction is coming back to inform the scientific reality in terms of different types of resurrection being possible.
Now, you are a presenter of Tomorrow's World, among other things.
Yes.
Is this Tomorrow's World? Are we going to see mammoths? Do you believe in it? Do you think we should go down this route?
There is, I'd say, a difference in my believing we should and that we can. I do believe that we can. And I by mammoths, I would not call them that. I would call them mammoth-elephant hybrids with the gene editing techniques that are being used to create, you know, elephants that will have woolly mammoth traits. I have no doubt that George Church will be able to get close to his goal at some point. He predicts that maybe by 2019 they'll have engineered the Asian elephant embryo to their degree of satisfaction with woolly mammoth genetic changes, and then there'll be a lot more experimentation to see if they can implant and possibly use an artificial womb technology to gestate these embryos. But there's a lot of failure we know along the way with these types of experiments, so it'll take some time. However, I am not a proponent of de-extinction, when taken as a strict definition of trying to bring back extinct species in some close form. I am enthused and interested in how technologies such as gene editing, cloning, engineering what are called induced pluripotent stem cells in order to regenerate new types of reproductive tissues from endangered animals will allow us to boost populations that are currently threatened of endangered species. I think there's a lot to be potentially learned from the overlap of synthetic biology and conservation biology. However, I think that de-extinction is mainly a really fascinating technological feat than it is an environmental necessity for conservation. I think there are ways to use extant species in many cases to be able to perform the ecosystem services that some people are interested in seeing de-extinction do. And I totally understand the fascination and the human project of wanting to look a woolly mammoth in the eye, for example. But for me, there are too many ethical issues along the way to say that I am rooting for de-extinction.
So, let's not hold our breath then after all. Britt Ray's Rise of the Necrofauna is published by Greystone Books, and Michael Brooks' The Quantum Astrologer's Handbook is with Scribe. Both are out in the UK now. There are thousands of podcasts in the Guardian archive on politics, science, technology, global development, and more. You can find them all at theguardian.com/podcasts. You can find us there as well, of course. Just open up your favourite podcast app and search for Guardian Books Podcast. You can join the conversation too, either by commenting on the Guardian website or at Guardian Books on Twitter. And you can get in touch with us via bookspodcast@theguardian.com. But for now, from me, Claire Armitstead, and my producer, Susanna Trezillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.